From the Sky News Centre at 5, the woman fired by her employers after the Baby P tragedy has won an appeal against her dismissal. Sharon Shoesmith, who was Director of Children's Services at Haringey Council when Peter Connolly died, was sacked by the former Labour Education Secretary Ed Balls. Government lawyers plan to challenge the ruling. Ms Shoesmith says she now wants to get her life back on track.
I'd love to go back to work. I loved my job. I was dedicated to my work. I have a huge commitment to children. I would love to go back to work. That's not possible. But I hope to carry on with my career with children in some capacity.
Britain has confirmed it's sending 4 Apache attack helicopters to Libya. They could be in action within 24 hours. The fighting in Libya has dominated much of the discussion on day 2 of the G8 summit in France. Prime Minister David Cameron said the military operation is entering a new phase.
Now there are signs that the momentum against Gaddafi is really building. So it's right that we are ratcheting up the military, the economic and the political pressure on the Gaddafi regime.
A woman has been jailed for 7 years for trying to sell her baby for £35,000. The 29-year-old from North East London can't be named for legal reasons. She was preparing to make the sale of her 11-month-old daughter at a hotel to undercover reporters when she was arrested. Police say 2 teenagers have been shot dead as they were chased down an alleyway in Milton Keynes last night. A 19-year-old man died at the scene, while the second man, aged 18, died this afternoon in hospital. There's been a sharp rise in the number of measles cases, according to the Health Protection Agency. Most cases occurred in London and the South East, followed by Yorkshire and Humber. And millions have headed off for the bank holiday weekend, with those choosing a trip abroad likely to be the lucky ones. Forecasters say those staying at home are in for a cool and rainy few days. Nearly 2 million are opting to go abroad. That's the latest. I'm Sasha.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and helping us review the news this week is the new Lib Dem councillor for Clifton East, Christian Martin. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, China orders the US to stay out of nuclear-armed Pakistan, but the US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton refuses. Is this brinkmanship wise? And in these modern wars, NATO are starting nowadays to the Geneva Convention seems to be out of the window, with often as many innocent civilians dying as soldiers. Another change has been that radiation left on the battlefield after depleted uranium shells are fired is leading to long-term genetic defects and hideous birth deformities. International Day for Innocent Child Victims of Aggression is coming up, and we speak to Joanne Baker about that. We also explore the possibility that 3 devastating world wars were planned before this current century, back around about 140 years ago. And also, before he took over Avon and Somerset Police, our Chief Constable Colin Port spent 3 years in Northern Ireland heading up the inquiry into the 1999 assassination of Catholic solicitor Rosemary Nelson. Well, 12 years on, there have still been no arrests, but the inquiry into her murder was published on Monday. All that's in the second hour after 6 o'clock. Well, on to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and a little rain. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius and sunny spells and showers over the weekend with some gusty winds. Next week, highs of 21 Celsius, wetter at the beginning of the week and warming up and sunnier towards the end. Next weekend, that's the 4th and 5th of June, highs of 20 Celsius and fairly sunny next weekend. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and with me is the new Lib Dem councillor for Clifton East, Christian Martin. Hi, Christian. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, first of all, Christian, as a new councillor, what's your background?
My background, in as much as you want to know how I started in politics, I was probably pre-voice-breaking 12-year-old, taking rather a lot of umbrage at the fact that my father was incredibly supportive of Margaret Thatcher's desire to go and fight for the Falklands. And so over many dinner conversations, I sort of honed a certain political view that was counter to his.
So were you brought up in a family where it was normal to discuss politics over the breakfast table, maybe over a supper table?
I think actually the political aspect of it came out of a pre-teen rebellion against authoritarian, disciplinarian, Victorian values that my father espoused as a conservative.
So the obvious thing now is, what do you think about Libya? Because this is a kind of modern equivalent to something like the Falklands, many people would say.
Yes, although we're not claiming sovereignty over Libya in the same way as we were over the Falklands, and still do. Libya is a big issue. It's seriously a concern for everyone. But I think that we can't sit back and allow what Gaddafi was threatening to do to his people in the way that we have unfortunately sat back in other instances.
So what about the Liberal Democrat Party? Why did you decide on the Lib Dems? Rather, you've already explained why you weren't so keen on the Conservatives, but why the Lib Dems and not Labour?
Well, therein hangs the tale. I mean, I've had a circuitous route to come back to the Liberal Democrats, having previously been a Liberal Democrat when I was in my teens, and actually fought as an activist for my first candidate back in 1987 for the Liberal Democrats. And then I moved over to Labour, funnily enough, to get rid of the Tories and to vote tactically, but worked for the party to help them when I lived in London. And then as soon as Blair got into power, I ripped up my card, realised it was the same old Tories that had just taken power, and rejoined the Liberal Democrats.
But now the Lib Dems are in bed with the Tories.
Yeah, nothing controversial in that. And the point that you're trying to make is...
Well, what I'm saying is that, you know, if you're brought up with difficulties with the Tory party, then now what you're doing
it
is...
It makes dinner conversation a lot easier. We have a coalition dinner party now.
Now,
in our family.
There is a coalition at Westminster, but there isn't here in Bristol. What do you think of what's been going on up in London, though? Because you must be... I mean, if you're against the Conservative Party, I would have thought you'd be tearing your hair out to see what's been going on. Certainly, this week, Vince Cable has been very outspoken about, for example, George Osborne's handling of the economy.
I think that the critical factor here is that the country stood on the edge of a precipice, you know, after the last election. We could have gone either way. We could have had a minority Conservative government, which I think would have been a disaster because it would have resulted very quickly in another election having to be called, which could have actually resulted in the Conservatives being returned to power with a full majority. That would have been an even greater disaster for the country than the ominous death toll that people are putting on the coalition policies. I think that the going into coalition was the right thing to do. I think it was the only option that we had available to us, and there's plenty of evidence that the Labour Party weren't prepared to really seriously consider or negotiate and the opportunity for us to go into coalition with them, regardless of the fact that in any event the numbers didn't stack up.
So what do you do outside politics? Have you got a professional background?
I'm a filmmaker and a distributor of independent stroke specialised art house films.
So will we have seen any of these films, or are they too obscure for us to watch?
No, I had a BAFTA-nominated film a few years ago called Le Grand Voyage, which was about a young man who takes his father to Mecca as part of the Hajj. that was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film. A couple of years ago, we made a film here in Bristol called Shank, which was one of the most successful independent gay films out of the UK. So, yeah, we're trucking along. You might have seen them.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is with me too. Martin, Ratko Mladic was arrested yesterday. Now, you were over in the Bosnian conflict working for the aid organisation CAFOD. Who was Ratko Mladic?
Well, he was the commander of the Bosnian Serb Republic army inside Bosnia, Republika Srpska. Pretty nasty piece of work, really.
So are you glad to see his arrest yesterday?
I think so, yes. It's part of Serbia's rehabilitation, really, to have these people handed over. Of course, it wasn't just the Serbs who were behaving badly, but Ratko Mladic has got a pretty bad reputation. I mean, basically, he was responsible for the massacre at Srebrenica.
Now, a conflict was going on between the Serbs and the Muslims. Why was that? And can you just give us a bit of background?
Well, it wasn't just the Serbs and the Muslims. It was also the Croats, who were Catholics, were the third protagonists, and in actual fact, each of those groups were factionalised within themselves. So there were actually pro-Serbian Muslims fighting for Fikret Abdic up in the Bihać pocket, who were actually fighting for on the side of Republika Srpska. The Croats had various internal fights with each other. It was, the closer you got to it, the more complicated it became, frankly. It was just a big mess.
So, I mean, it was really the end of Tito and the end of the Yugoslavia. Do you think that there were mistakes made at that stage when Tito died?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that was quite clear is that the Yugoslavia was actually one of the most marketised of all the East European countries. So they actually got into sort of stagflation and economic collapse quicker than everybody else. And then, of course, the recognition of Slovenia and Croatia, which was pushed for by Germany, led to a disorderly breakup of Yugoslavia rather than a planned breakup. And basically, a lot of the tectonic plates of world politics run through the region, so they have a very unfortunate history.
Now, so Serbian war crime suspect Ratko Mladic was arrested yesterday. Ironically, one of the first people to give his reaction was fellow potential war criminal Tony Blair.
This is a huge moment for the principle that people who engage in genocide will eventually be brought to justice, obviously, but also for Serbia.
Martin Summers, double standards from Tony? Do you think that's pushing a point?
Basically, he has got to, you know, wars of aggression are the supreme crime, as was decided at Nuremberg, and lying to have a war of aggression is a crime. And Tony Blair's probably killed more people than Ratko Mladic, hasn't he?
Well, I must say, just at the beginning of when it was time for the Iraq war was just beginning, and Claire Short resigned, and she was saying basically that Blair wasn't allowing any proper discussion of it in the cabinet, I sent this information up to the International Criminal Court, and they wouldn't even give me acknowledgement that they'd got this information.
Isn't it fascinating that the biggest country on the planet that isn't in the International Criminal Court is the United States of America, and it's quite clear why they don't want to be in it, because their guys would definitely have to stand trial for the things they've done. That's why they don't want to join in.
Christian Martin, Lib Dem councillor for Clifton East, just elected at this latest local election. What are your thoughts on the arrest of Ratko Mladic and generally about war crimes?
Well, I mean, I think there have been quite a few commentators that have made the point about the fact that they've been trying to track him down and find him for years, and they've only just found him just as Serbia is crying out to join the EU. So I think there's a question mark over that.
Martin, I see you nodding there.
Yeah, that seems likely.
Yeah, it seems very likely to me as well. You know, but just going back to the point about Tony Blair his comments as well. You know, I also have written to various authorities in the House of Commons and Lords to actually get some clarification on his role as the Middle East peace envoy, although I understand it's not actually a peace envoy, he's there as a trade envoy. But in any event, my question that I put to them was, in very rapidly being given this position, did it come with diplomatic immunity, which is why he seems to be walking on water wherever he goes, with regards to the fact that he knows he's going to be above prosecution because of that diplomatic immunity. I have not had an answer to that yet.
Okay, so on to our next story. The bus routes are in fear of a £2 million shortfall. This is in the Evening Post. Bus services across Bristol could be cut as the City Council is facing £2.2 million budget shortfall. Morning, evening, Sunday and bank holiday services being cut. Now, Christian Martin, it seems rather convenient that Gary Hopkins, who was in charge of transport, is no longer doing that this year. And it's Tim Kent, I think, is another Liberal Democrat councillor that's having to carry the can. Also, with First Bus making something like £100 million profit, why are we subsidising any of the buses in Bristol?
That's a very good question. But I think, you know, I fought my campaign in the election on the Greater Bristol Bus Network, which is a good news story for Bristol. You know, where there is a huge investment going into sorting out the transport problems that exist here by redeveloping road links across the city, which already in the two areas of St George's and Gloucester Road, where it's already up and running, we've seen bus prices come down and we've seen a greater efficiency and a greater reliability of the bus service. So, I mean, there are positive stories to be had to the transport issues here in Bristol.
Well, it's difficult to think that if you're standing at a bus stop and the bus isn't coming, and also when the fares are going up. So what is this Great Bristol Bus Network and why is it going to change things?
And the Great Bristol Bus Network is across the entire city. It's a £70 million project, and it's designed to increase the number of widened roads in some instances, create specific bus lanes, deal with certain parking issues across the city, but more importantly, to encourage people to use the buses as a consequence of a £70 million investment, some of which is coming from government, some of which is coming from First Group as an investment, and some of which is coming from the local taxpayer through the council budget. But that budget specifically also being majority made up of Section 106 money, which is money specifically given by developers when they create
a new building. A sort of bribe that developers give, isn't it? Once you give them planning permission, if you say yes, we'll give you planning permission if we get a bit of Section 106 money. I mean, at least a lot of people do talk about it.
I think it's legislation that they have to give 106 money as a condition of the development, rather than you actually being bribed to give them planning permission.
No. A lot of people in fish ponds particularly are saying, well, hang on a minute, this is not a greater Bristol bus network, this is just a mess, because all you've done is you've shifted the bus stops out into towards the middle of the road, so that when a bus stops, there's gridlock behind it.
Yeah, but it's not all been connected up yet. You know, the bus network per se has not been completed yet, so it's section by section, part of the city by part of the city is being done. Once it's all together, I'm sure you'll see far greater rapidity of bus service. As I said, in the two areas where it's already running, they're seeing reliability of the bus service at record highs. They're seeing the number of people taking the buses going up by 15%. And as a consequence of that, bus companies are bringing the prices of tickets down. Now, that is a good news story.
So is it the idea that if you slow the cars right down and create gridlock, then people will be forced onto the buses? Is that the concept? Or maybe onto a bike?
I think if petrol prices keep going up, we'll all go on the bus, you know.
Okay, Martin. We do every month at least. We have a story about First Bus. They're sort of the big bugbear in the city. What are your thoughts about this story? Again, we're being told big cuts to the subsidies and cuts to services.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you pointed out earlier, this is a bit bizarre that we've got a private profit-making company which is subsidised by the taxpayer. I mean, why are we doing that? I mean, if you go to other parts of Europe, I don't know, Stockholm or Bologna, you'll find that the municipal bus service is excellent in those cities, and they just subsidise it and there's no private profit taken. We've just got used to this kind of rubbish system in Britain because we just got used to it, but that's not really what the rest of the world does.
Christian...
Let's not forget that on the trains, you know, for years and years and years, the Labour Party subsidised up the wazoo, as did the Conservatives when they privatised it, the private companies with taxpayers' money to run the train
service.
That's
rubbish. I mean, I am opposed to the privatisation of the railways, of course. I mean, and we've still got a dog's breakfast all these years later.
Absolutely. And it is endemic within this country that we fail to actually tackle our transport issues.
We do, because there's no planning.
So, Christian, yeah. I'm asking you, you're a Europhile, all the Liberal Democrats pretty much are, why aren't we doing things like the Europeans are?
That's a huge question, but I mean, I think at the end of the day, we spend a lot of time coming up against the bureaucrats in government that actually create resistance to us actually looking at alternative methods of transportation. You know, look at what happened here in Bristol when we proposed the Green Initiative for the Hydrogen Ferry, which is an alternative transport system across the city of Bristol, and it got poo-pooed, it got condemned, it got completely ridiculed as a waste of money by the Conservatives, without them actually looking at the wider issues and ramifications of what that initiative was intended to create in terms of jobs, green technology, green industry, green businesses, etc., etc., etc. So, you know, I don't know what the answer is. I have no panacea right in front of me at the moment.
Well, I know Martin knows what the answer is, which is nationalise these things, but Martin, we haven't got the money to do it, have we?
Or municipalise them.
Municipalise. You mean have the local authority retake control of the bus network?
But I mean, we've had 13 years of Labour government and they did nothing to reverse the idiotic policies that had been pursued in the previous decade, and that's why 20 years later we've got a dog's breakfast and a mess. We should have made plans about this years and years and years ago. I mean, places like Sweden, they just laugh at us. We just get used to all of this, and we just think it's normal.
Well, Labour copped out when they had the opportunity to renationalise the railways.
They did. In New Zealand, they didn't. In New Zealand, the new Labour, the PR elected Labour government in New Zealand forced out the first past the post people who were far too far in bed with the IMF. And the first thing they did was renationalise the railways. And the railways in New Zealand today are owned by the government, even though they've got a right wing government.
Absolutely. What was it, a rail track over here that they took back into?
Yeah, well, they had to, because it was just falling apart.
At that point, they had the opportunity to renationalise the entire lot.
Well, they didn't. Did they?
No,
well,
they didn't.
No, terrible.
Talking about things falling apart, the Southern Cross elderly people's care home story is coming up a bit later. But before that, next story, a hunt for an attacker who put a pacifist in hospital. A well-known anti-war protester has been left disabled by an unprovoked attack. Cliff Hanley, who's devoted himself to political causes around the globe, is still in hospital after a vicious assault on Good Friday. Police released CCTV footage of the man they suspect carried out the attack. And you can see that on the Avon Somerset Police website and on the Evening Post website, because one of the commenters has thoughtfully posted up a picture from the Avon and Somerset site on the Evening Post site. So anyway, the Evening Post previously appealed for witnesses to the crime to come forward, but it was not until yesterday Mr. Hanley's name and the severity of his condition was released by Avon and Somerset Police. Martin, now I know you've met Cliff several times, and Cliff was one of the people that went over to try and run through food to the Gaza blockade. What are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, he was nearly shot. I mean, 9 of his colleagues were shot dead. He was nearly shot on that boat. And I think it's absolutely disgraceful that he comes back to Britain and is engaged in a peaceful process and is attacked by thugs who have basically, he's lost his sight. And he's had a brain hemorrhage.
Now, you spoke to Richard, who was actually at the peace vigil at the time. So what actually happened?
Well, from what I understand, these guys were drinking in the pub over the road. They came over and had an altercation with Richard and Cliff. They went back into the pub, and then they came back out again when they'd had a couple of drinks, and they just attacked Cliff, who's a 62-year-old guy. Two of them attacked him. Very nasty.
It also says, as part of this story, that it looks like he may not regain the proper use of his sight as well.
You can bet the guys who hit him have never heard a shot fired in anger.
Christian Martin, what are your thoughts on this story?
I'm horrified by it. I think any act of violence against another person is to be abhorred. And you know, in this instance, you've got a man who has dedicated quite clearly a large part of his life to being charitable and helping others, in particular risking his own life in the food aid that he took to Palestine, all of which in of itself is a completely other big story that requires some attention at some point to be discussed. But in this instance, he coming back to Bristol and suffering that fate is just appalling.
And the other thing is, this has all been done in the sort of, admittedly, it's Good Friday, so there weren't necessarily as many cars around as usual, but in the rush hour, right in front of everyone, with all the CCTV cameras that we got in the city centre, and yet there's still apparently only this kind of quite fuzzy picture of the guy that allegedly done it.
Well, hopefully they'll catch them.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a big question mark to be asked there about, you know, the CCTV footage and why it wasn't clearer and why... I mean, we're obviously continually reminded by the police not to intercede and not to engage in assisting people if it looks like it's a violent, confrontational situation. But if this happened in full view of other people, you know, it does beg the question, what happened to the Good Samaritans in our society?
Well, there were various witnesses. I mean, the police did interview people who were there. I mean, the guy is white, about 5'8" tall, stocky, in his 30s, with light mousy brown, short spiky hair, and wearing pink and grey polo shirt with dark jeans, carrying headphones. Go get him, folks.
Yeah, let's hope we find him.
Detective Sergeant Michael Harris said, since the assault, it's become clear that Cliff's injuries are a lot more serious than we first thought. They are now considered life-changing, so we'll be living with the effects of the assault for a long time. We're continuing to investigate this unprovoked and unacceptable assault. Call the police if you know anything about this on 0845 4567 000 or Crime Stoppers on 0800 555 111. Just to give that description again, he's white, about 5'8" tall, stocky, and in his 30s. He had a light mousy brown short spiky hair and was wearing a pink and grey polo shirt with dark jeans and carrying headphones. Okay, our next story, Facebook boss Mark Zuckerberg, who incidentally has also been invited up to the G8. He seems to be the flavour of the month, doesn't he? Conference this weekend.
He's got money.
Probably, yes. He wants children under 13 to use Facebook. The founder of Facebook says he will fight to allow under 13s to use the social networking site despite warnings that it would put the most vulnerable children at risk. Apparently the under 13 market is a prime target for advertisers, and bringing them on to social networking sites will provide a boon for the companies involved. Facebook has been repeatedly attacked for its poor online security in the face of appalling cases involving bullies, criminals and sexual predators, turning it to their advantage. And also, there is no specific place on the Facebook site where you can report what you believe to be underage use of the website. So, Martin, do you want to start on this one? What are your thoughts on Mark Zuckerberg wanting under-13s on Facebook?
Well, I don't really... I mean, it's very difficult to police these things, isn't it? I mean, how can you stop under-13s using Facebook if they've got the technical skills to get onto it? This raises the whole question of, you know, children using the internet and all of the dangers that implies. I mean, it's just very difficult to control these things, isn't it?
Christian?
Well, I mean, I think this is the another example of the crapulous side of capitalism, where someone is seeing an opportunity to make some more money without thinking about the consequences in terms of the risk that young people are being put at. I think Martin's right. You can't police it, but you could make it the responsibility of Facebook to police the young people that are already using the website, or Facebook rather, to from predators, etc. There's plenty of examples of young people that have unfortunately fallen victim to people on there, and quite apart from the bullying aspects of it and so on and so forth. But I'm opposed. I've got nephews and nieces that are under 13, and I would not want to see them on Facebook. You know, I've got several pages on Facebook that I use to promote our films, and some of the people that want to friend that page are certainly suspect, in my opinion. I don't think it's I don't think necessarily it's the safest environment.
A related story, after land, sea, air and space, this is the newest and therefore the most secret battlefield NATO and the US military are determined to win on. At least that's what co-founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, said in an exclusive interview with satellite and Freeview channel Russia Today's Laura Emmett.
Facebook in particular is the most appalling spying machine that has ever been invented. Here we have the world's most comprehensive database about people, their relationships, their names, their addresses, their locations, their communications with each other, their relatives, all sitting within the United States, all accessible to US intelligence. Facebook, Google, Yahoo, all these major US organizations have built-in interfaces for US intelligence. It's not a matter of serving a subpoena. They have an interface that they have developed for US intelligence to use. Now, is it the case that Facebook is actually run by US intelligence? No, it's not like that. It's simply that US intelligence is able to bring to bear legal and political pressure to them, and it's costly for them to hand out records and one by one, so they have automated the process. Everyone should understand that. When they add their friends to Facebook, they are doing free work for United States intelligence agencies in building this database for them.
That was the co-founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, there talking in an interview with the Freeview channel Russia Today a couple of weeks ago. Martin Summers, do you think he's exaggerating there, Julian Assange, or does he know something that we don't?
No, I mean, basically all electronic communications are buggable. Microsoft has always had an NSA backdoor, so the National Security Agency in the US is able to access it. They you know, the Echelon has existed for many years, which is basically Western listening stuff. GCHQ is the British corner of Echelon. Frankly, anything electronic is accessible to intelligence services. Everybody should realise that.
Which is why
the resistance in Iraq, for example, don't use mobile phones.
But what he's saying there is pretty astounding, isn't it? That if you're actually adding friends to Facebook, you're doing work for the American intelligence services. Christian Martin, Lib Dem councillor, what are your thoughts on that statement?
Goodness me, I work for the American government now, apparently, according to the 200 and miserably 73 friends that I've got on Facebook. I think there's potentially an element of paranoia, and but underlying that, some truth probably in what he says. As Martin says, you know, most electronic devices these days can track you. We hand over so much information, so much data on ourselves on a daily basis. You know, it stands to reason that someone somewhere is collating this information. I'm not suggesting that it's ultimately being racked and stacked into some computer system for nefarious activity down the line. But we hand over information all the time. How do you avoid that?
I suppose you use a bubble.
I mean,
you use snail mail, you use letters, or you go and actually post something through somebody's door. I mean, you can't get too.
I understand that they've never quite worked out how to open letters which have been sellotaped.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, I don't know. If you sellotape your letters down, they really don't.
But
know
you how steam to the sellotape off.
No,
that's what I always do with your letters.
You can't restick it.
We are using the internet more and more and more, aren't we? Because it's so much more convenient. But one of the things that we have to say at the moment, the BBC, in their old-fashioned way, seem to be going through a bit of a renaissance at the moment. They've got, on Monday evenings, an Adam Curtis very good documentary series called The Rise of the Machines. And I think, what did you say the title of the one this week was that you saw, Martin?
Watched Over by Machines of Love and Power, I think.
Love and Grace. Did you see? Have you been watching?
I haven't had a chance to watch any television this week. I've been so busy.
Well, there was quite an interesting thing in the programme where he was talking. This woman was talking about people using social networking sites, and she was saying, "I suddenly realised that I was actually commodifying my own feelings and emotions." And that these, you know, I'd put my stuff up there on bulletin boards, and somebody had taken that and used it as a raw material for a commodity. And I suddenly realised that I'd actually basically facilitated that. That was just one aspect, one little aspect of the programme. It was mostly about financial crash, actually.
So that's Adam Curtis's series at the moment on BBC on Monday evenings, and there's also on Thursday evenings a very good drama series called The Shadow Line, which is I don't know what your thoughts are as a filmmaker on modern day television, Christian, but a lot of it seems to be quite dull, and it's nice to see we've got, you know, at least two things a week worth watching.
I don't know that it's dull. I think that actually British TV, especially its dramas, is getting better. You know, I think it's beginning to, you know, in comparison to America, where they have on average, you know, 8 to 12 scriptwriters per show, and the fact that over here in the UK it's invariably just one scriptwriter per episode of a drama, I think we compete on a playing field that isn't level in an incredibly sophisticated and accomplished way, and I think British drama on TV is getting better.
Well, before we completely leave the subject of the US, the President Barack Obama stopped off in London on his way to the G8 conference this week, and as well as confirming that the US Embassy will not be paying the congestion charge, it's been bills been racking up over the last 10 years or so on the grounds of diplomatic immunity, he had this to say about the rather more important subjects of Libya and the Arab Spring.
As historic change unfolds across the Middle East and North Africa, we agree that the pursuit of self-determination must be driven by the peoples of the region and not imposed from the outside. But we are both committed to doing everything that we can to support peoples who reach for democracy and leaders who implement democratic reform. Tomorrow we'll discuss with our G8 partners how those of us in the wider international community can best support nations that make the reforms necessary to build the framework for democracy, freedom and prosperity for their people. At the same time, we will continue to strongly oppose the use of violence against protesters and any efforts to silence those who yearn for freedom and dignity and basic human rights. And that's one of the reasons that we are working together in Libya, alongside with our NATO allies and partners, to protect the Libyan people and we will continue those operations until Gaddafi's attacks on civilians cease. Time is working against Gaddafi, and he must step down from power and leave Libya to the Libyan people.
That was US President Barack Obama there speaking earlier this week, making it very clear that regime change is the object of what's going on right now in Libya. But Labour MP Dennis Skinner was not so upbeat about the Libya war.
Labour MP Dennis Skinner complained that the whole enterprise had been spearheaded by the French president with an eye on next year's elections.
How many civilians have been killed by NATO forces, the ones that we're supposed to safeguard? And when will we be reaching £1 billion expenditure on this intervention paid by the British taxpayer?
Now, Martin Summers, is it regime change or is it a no-fly zone? What is going on?
Well, as you know, I was a spokesperson to stop the war when this battle started, as it were, and I was actually in two minds about a no-fly zone. I thought maybe a no-fly zone was justified. For example, there was a no-fly zone in Bosnia when I was an aid worker there. But we've discovered, as I've mentioned before on the show, if people go to the French Air Force website, they will see something there called Operation Southern Mistral 2011, which has been up on the French Air Force website since November of last year. And it's a war game which is actually exactly the same as the war against Libya. It involves the British and French Air Forces. It involves a North African country, unnamed.
Yes, but the war game was actually over France.
The south of France was called Southland, but it was supposed to be a North African country, unnamed. And they also involved a UN resolution. What appears to have happened is that these rebels inside the eastern part of Libya have been armed and directed by NATO intelligence. And in actual fact, the number of the people in the Benghazi government, we're told there are 30 people in it, but only about 10 of them have been named. The suspicion is that the other 20 are actually from the Islamic Fighting Group of Libya, which is Al-Qaeda Libya, which has had links with Western intelligence for many, many years. I think this whole thing has actually been agreed in advance. And if we're talking about trying to kill Gaddafi, as we tried to do last week, I would say that the King of Bahrain and his children are definitely targets. And of course, the Bahraini people don't have aircraft. They'll have to use car bombs. And of course, if we are going to fight to the death to finish despotism, then the King Fahd of Saudi Arabia will have to die, and his children. I think the West has got itself into a right mess here.
Christian Martin, Lib Dem councillor, what are your thoughts about the debacle in Libya? And most importantly, this mission creep. It started off as a UN resolution and a no-fly zone, and now, quite clearly, the object is regime change.
I think there are some interesting points being raised by Dennis Skinner and by Martin. I think the cost is one aspect that clearly is of concern to people that are now feeling the pinch as the cuts begin to bite. I hope to goodness that this is not going to be one of those situations that just plays out for an incredibly long time and it gets us stuck in the mire for ages. You know, look, it took us 10 years to get out of Iraq. We're still talking about getting out of Afghanistan. We can't afford, either as a nation, we can't afford the lives of any of our soldiers to go and fight over there in Libya. But we must do what we can.
But what about the Air Force? Because you're not really risking people if they're up in a plane,
exactly.
Are you?
Therefore, we must do what we can in probably the most risk-averse way that we can, by using Air Force to try and effect some change over there. Regime change? Yeah, I personally have an issue with the whole idea of regime change from the point of view that we seem to pick and choose who we want to change regimes.
What about these attack helicopters? It's been announced today the British attack helicopters will be going in. Do you think that that's in line with the UN resolution and the no-fly zone? Because it seems to be, rather than sort of taking out command and control, there's now more and more going to be happening on the ground. And these helicopters are obviously able to do a lot more than the planes are from up much higher.
Well, it seems like the next logical step in trying to expedite a resolution to this situation, you know, and for it to reach a conclusion.
But isn't a ceasefire, isn't that also a resolution? Because Gaddafi is right now is desperately suing for peace.
How many ceasefire options have we had from Colonel Gaddafi that have proven to come to naught? You know, he says he wants a ceasefire, he says he's in the middle of a ceasefire, and yet we've still got the evidence of him killing his people. You know, it's very difficult to believe someone as mendacious as Gaddafi, isn't it?
Okay, well, anyway, on to our next story. And actually, Marina Morris has got a report for us on the progress with the Big Society.
Hello. The Big Society debate is continuing. According to the former Labour Secretary of the State for Communities, Hazel Blair's giving by the top hungry donors has gone down by a third this year. There is a $3 billion gap in funding for charities. The director of the Big Society Network, Paul Twivy, whose role is promoting the Big Society, says this policy is divisive in the cabinet. It is increasingly hated by the public. Hazel believes that the banks should donate excess profit to charity. Banks have put some money into the Big Society banks, but will not fill the gap of £3 billion. This idea is echoed by the chairman of the Association of Chief Executive of Voluntary Organization, Sir Stephen Babb, who said that businesses need to do more and banks need to do more. This is a suggestion that 1% of banks' profit should go to the charity. According to Conservative MP Francis Mott, there are three elements to the bigger society. One is all of the social action, philanthropic, voluntary. The second is opening up public services. And the third is giving power back to communities. Sky News reported the charity's funding gap was £5 billion, not three. So these estimates should be regarded as very rough. A white paper called Giving, published this month, advises that the British people already give more than £10 billion each year to charities, but looks for ways of encouraging us to give more. To help address the shortfall, the white paper promises a £30 million local infrastructure fund, a giving summit, and a year-long national payroll giving campaign to try and plug a multi-billion pound hole. The prospect for many businesses also appear gloomy according to three key measures. First, the BackBiz Trainer Red Flag report in the first quarter of 2011 shows around 187,000 UK businesses were experiencing significant or critical financial problems. Compare this 162,000 in quarter 1 2010, a 15% year-on-year increase when compared to quarter 1 2010, or 26% increase compared to quarter 4 2010. ISM Tenor Trucks Traffic Light report for March identify a 4% rise in the number of retail companies deemed a high risk of insolvency compared to February, and 2% higher than a year ago. A survey by accountants Wilkins Kennedy shows an increase in the number of retail companies using company voluntary arrangement to reschedule. Their debts has increased by 15% in a year. The competition for funds is heating up. The best guarantor of survival is efficiency. The fittest charities, along with many other organizations, will survive.
Lib Dem councillor for Clifton East, Christian Martin. This is a bit of a report here on the how the Big Society is doing. But what it's basically saying is that the money seems to be drying up for the Big Society, and many of our charities are going under.
Yeah, I don't speak for the party when I pose here an opinion, which is my own personal one, but, you know, the Big Society is about as bankrupt as Majors, back to basics.
So it's not lasted very long?
I don't think I ever understood it. I don't think that anybody ever understood it, and I don't think it was an electioneering tool that Cameron waved around to try and mesmerise us all into believing that... you know, he felt a little bit more about the country than I necessarily think he probably does.
Yeah, well, obviously I agree with that. I mean, basically the Big Society is just vacuous, especially when people in the voluntary sector, and I used to be a worker in the voluntary sector, everybody's being cut and thrown out of work. And I know somebody who works in Connections, for example, and they're sacking people and making them and cutting people's wages. And the idea is that they're going to bring people in who will voluntarily do the kind of advice work that they do. And this is just fatuous because, of course, you can't have amateur people giving advice, because they don't know what they're talking about, and they're going to give the wrong advice. So this is how bad it's got, that people are thinking in these terms. Absolutely pointless.
I mean, also, I think it's incredibly patronising to people that actually work voluntarily for charities, to suggest that, you know, society should take on an even greater burden, and for some of these charities to take on even greater activities in areas that they already are stretched in to begin with. You know, and I just think in that regard, you know, my mother, who volunteers in a museum, she volunteers in a divorce centre, she volunteers in a whole range of things. And they're the backbone of this country. That's the bit where I'm actually in favour of the big society, those people that are volunteers that go unreported, that go unmentioned.
But it looks like the actual result of the Cameron government is to actually put the knife in the back of the big society, because we see the big donations to charities have gone down by a third, and there's a $3 billion gap in funding for charities now.
Yeah, isn't it absolutely outrageous that the Conservatives, and I can say this despite the fact that we're in coalition because we're two different parties, you know, isn't it outrageous that he talks about the need for the gap to be filled with philanthropy when in point of fact, companies out there, week in, week out, are getting are reporting enormous profits out of the back of a recession, and yet contributions to charities don't seem to be going up at all from these major institutions. There's something that's not connecting. There's a disconnect somewhere, and I'm not really sure where we're heading.
Martin, it is important, our charitable sector, and it's very worrying that there's £3 billion less funding for charities.
Yes, and I think if you think to the new Labour area, the whole social enterprise, I used to work in the social enterprise section of the council, there's an element of fantasy about all of this.
But isn't it one of the reasons for this, simply that interest rates are very low, and many of these foundations that fund charities, they make their money on big deposits and interest on their savings?
The real fundamental problem, and I don't know whether we're going to come on to this, but we might as well mention it now, is that the deficit is increasing and the economy is about to crash, because the economic policy pursued by the coalition, frankly, is idiotic, and by the end of the year it's going to be absolutely obvious to everybody, because we're going to lose our credit rating because of the cuts. There's economic illiteracy at the head of all of our parties, including the Labour Party.
Well, one of the stories that we're going to talk about, we may as well talk about it now since you just brought it up, Martin, is Vince Cable. So Vince is saying that Britain faces another economic crash. This is Robert Winnett writing in the Daily Telegraph yesterday. Britain's failed to appreciate the seriousness of the economic crisis and faces another financial crash. Vince Cable's talking about economic hydrogen bombs being out there and accusing the coalition of failing to get to grips with the threat. This is a bit worrying. And alongside that, we're being told by the Daily Mail that our economy is stagnated. Dismal figures show the UK has seen no growth for 6 months. We've seen the biggest drop in household spending since 2009. Investment in business is down 7%. Economists are downgrading growth predictions again for the second time this year. A whole load of bullet points. I really haven't got time to go through.
Yes, and also the deficit is increasing.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in uncharted territory here to some degree. I mean, all of the economists of old, from Keynes down, you know, people are studying them and trying to figure out where on earth we're going at the moment. And I don't think anybody's got any answers, to be brutally honest.
Well, Martin generally does have a few answers. Martin, if you were Chancellor, okay, right now in George Osborne's shoes, and you were seeing this kind of these dismal economic figures, again, an increase in the deficit, despite all this pain we're going through, what would you do right now?
Well, the obvious thing to do is, when you're in a hole, stop digging. Basically, we need to reread Keynes. Keynes was a liberal, and he understood how the economy works. You can't cut your way out of a crash. I think Vince Cable knows this, and he's starting to break cover. The Labour Party has got to be bolder in making its pitch to the electorate, because they were saying, "Oh, we will cut, but not so hard."
But why aren't the Labour Party being bolder?
Because we've got a neoliberal coterie on the right wing of the party who don't want to have a serious discussion about the economy. They think it all takes care of itself, the market works, and all we've got to do is manage it. They're wrong. We've got to actually have a real discussion about what the economy's for, and we haven't had it yet. We will have it after the crash, because we're going to have millions of unemployed, and then we're going to have a real serious discussion.
But what are you trying to say, that the alternative to cutting is to keep borrowing and
spending? You've actually got to fiscally consolidate. The wealthy classes in this country have done very well out of the bubble of the last 30 years. Very well indeed. Many of them started off as millionaires and are now billionaires. Where's all the money gone? It's gone into their pockets. Now, this is what the Austrian school calls malinvestment. This is the von Hayek and all these people, the extreme right of the economic spectrum. Now, if there's malinvestment, there's no real profits. The profits that the bank's supposedly making are not real profits. They're actually based on fraud and accounting error. Now, in actual fact, they're not entitled to that money, and we want it back. That's the money which we're going to put into our big society.
Or isn't it an alternative that, you know, we go after these companies that are avoiding tax?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if we're at war and people are fighting and dying for this country, in many misconceived wars, in my view, then the people are, some people pay with blood and some people pay with money. And in the 1950s, when we were fighting the Korean War, the top rate of tax was 96% under a conservative government. Because people knew what the deal was. You provide the money, we provide the cannon fodder. There's, people have forgotten all about this, and there's an idea that we can't possibly raise taxes on the rich because they'll all run away. Well, the answer to that is you can go if you like, but you won't come back. You will lose your citizenship. If you want to go and live in Belize, you will live in Belize.
Now, one of the symptoms of all this is one of this story, which is the marketisation of what used to be the public sector care homes in the balance as Southern Cross struggles. This has been some excellent reporting in The Guardian over this Southern Cross elderly people's care home story. Financial chaos of the care home provider Southern Cross is a salutary tale for government pursuing market-driven reforms. This is Anna Borden and Richard Alcock in The Guardian this Wednesday. Last week, the future of 750 elderly care homes hung in the balance after the UK biggest operator warned it may not have enough funds to stay in business beyond June. Now, again, you know, your Conservative partners up in Westminster, Christian Martin, this is one of their policies, and actually one of yours too, marketising these kind of things and actually trying to take what used to be the public sector, pare it down and merge it with the private sector. But in this case, we're looking at 750 care homes potentially closing here.
Well, I think also one has to remember that the care home crisis, to some extent, it was created back in the 90s when Thatcher gave tax breaks to people to set themselves up as care homes. Mm. And so in the same way as we had the buy-to-let fiasco, so we've now got a care home fiasco and a mounting crisis. Again, I think it's down to the fact that people are scrabbling around trying to come up with solutions and ideas to these things because of the fact that, you know, they're coming back to haunt us now and bite us on the backside.
Latest half-yearly results show that Southern Cross, as in the last half-year, made a £311 million loss. And Southern Cross is looking after, just about by its fingernails, 31,000 residents. Martin.
Yeah, well, it's a classic example. The private sector fails and then the public sector has to step in. And the public sector, presumably, will have to step in and rescue these homes. There's nothing else. I mean, you can't move all these elderly people. They will have to be rescued. And that will be more expenditure by the public sector to bail out the private sector. I think there's a message here for the privatisation proposals in the National Health Service. And I was very pleased to see the Liberal Democrat Spring Conference draw a line in the sand there. Mm-hmm. Very pleased to see that indeed. We need a bit of common sense. I mean, you are the government, not you, but your party is in the government.
Yeah, and we're continuing to fight on that.
It's up to you to talk some sense into them.
Yeah.
Next story, the untold story of the gagging orders. This is back to the good old super injunction story. Hundreds of reporting restrictions are remaining in force and the public knows next to nothing about them. This is a very interesting investigation by the Independent newspaper that found that there are more than 333 gagging orders protecting the identities of celebrities, children and private individuals. And this is all about, of course, the balance between the rights to privacy and the rights of freedom of the press. I mean, from my personal point of view, I just want to be able to talk about whatever I think the public need to know about, but you can't always do that, of course, if there's an injunction out. The 333 gagging orders analysed by the Independent include a footballer alleging blackmail after a group sex session in a hotel was captured on a mobile phone, a company accused of pollution, a member of the public that didn't want the press to report a sex change, a woman who had a laptop containing all her sex videos stolen, a betting company that obtained an injunction against disclosing information about its clients betting, tens of Premier League footballers who are family men in public but who are in reality promiscuous cheats, and a media personality who denied alcohol addiction. Well, Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week to ask you what you think of the super injunction and where you stand on the balance between privacy and the freedom of the press.
Does it matter what the newspapers print about the rich and famous?
Well, if it's true, then if it's something we ought to know, then it's fair enough. But if it's just their personal life, then it's absolutely none of our business. And I really don't care what someone rich and famous is doing.
My thing depends whether they've got any power or influence. And then I think you might need to know things if they're trying to preach one thing and actually in their private life they're doing something different. Or if they're funded by public money, then it might be an issue as well.
I guess it only matters to the people that care about it. If you don't care about it, then it doesn't really matter. If that's how you get your fun from reading about other people's misfortune, then I guess that's fair enough. But I don't particularly care about it, no.
No, doesn't matter to me, no.
Not really, no. It's their business, isn't it? They feel they keep it private, they keep it private.
Where would you draw the line between privacy and freedom of the press?
If it's something that actually has an effect on the general people, then clearly we should know about it. But I think everyone's entitled to their own privacy. And there are so many things that are in the newspapers which are of absolutely no relevance to us.
Yeah, I think gossip is just a waste of space.
I think privacy becomes a problem where someone can't defend themselves against the press. And that's where I'd say you perhaps draw a line of... if you're printing stuff about Ryan Giggs, that's one thing. If you're printing stuff about a builder who hasn't got all the facilities to get solicitors and secure himself and keep safe, then it's a whole different matter.
Well, I think the press have too much freedom anyway, to be honest. I don't think it's right that... Not that I'm advocating communism, but I just don't think it's necessarily right that they can write whatever they want and anger people, whether it's questions about war or famine or whatever. They feel they can write whatever they want, but then again, you don't have to read it if you don't want to read it.
I think the press have a duty to report as honestly as possible, so I would draw my line, or I would certainly come down on the side of freedom of the press. Probably certain cases where that isn't relevant, security for the state, for instance, but generally I'm in favour of freedom for the press. I think it's important in a free democracy, which is what Britain claims to be, that we're allowed to ask questions of anybody on any subject without censorship. Like I say, there's possibly cases where that's not appropriate, but generally that would be my feelings, that the press have a duty to ask questions on our behalf.
No, you need to please yourself in this country. It's a free country, you see. Say what you want to.
Does a free press change the behaviour of the rich and famous?
I think it's important for them to actually act as role models, because if they know that something they do that's irresponsible is going to be in the press, they should behave themselves. But on the whole, they probably don't care. A bit of newspaper coverage is probably good for them, whether it's good or bad.
Well, yeah, because it makes them take out super injunctions, doesn't it? So it does do that. And then I suppose it makes them a bit more careful about what they do, perhaps makes them a bit more secretive about things.
I think the rich are going to do whatever the rich want to do anyway. I don't think they read the papers. They make the papers. They make the papers. Quote me on that.
Well, they just do what they want to, don't they, the rich? They're rich, you just go on. They didn't worry about the underdogs, did they? The proletariat's kept onto the ground.
You'd like to think so, but the reality seems to be that it doesn't really matter. The rich and famous can still get away with pretty much doing what they want. I say we live in a democracy. It's not really democracy. It's actually levels and levels of different kind of class and status and elites that have access either to information or the gagging of that information. Unfortunately, that's just the way it is. So generally, I would say no, it doesn't really have too much effect on the rich.
That was Marina Morris out asking you what you think of the super injunctions. Now, just quickly, Christian Martin, Lib Dem councillor, what are your thoughts on the balance between privacy and press freedom?
Well, I think what's more worrying is the fact that there seems to now be a cost to affording yourself some privacy.
Martin?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's all been determined by checkbooks, isn't it? Which is completely unacceptable.
Okay, well, we're coming up now to time for the Sky News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, that was Lib Dem councillor for Clifton East, Christian Martin. After the news, China orders the US to stay out of nuclear-armed Pakistan, but US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton refuses. So, what's going on with the brinkmanship? And in these modern wars NATO are starting nowadays, the Geneva Convention seem to be out of the window, as often as many innocent civilians dying as there are soldiers. Another huge change is the radiation left on the battlefield. That's coming up after the Sky News at 6 o'clock.
Your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol.